They told me I was just chasing ghosts, but when I stepped inside the first abandoned asylum, I found more than dust. I found names, files, offshore accounts, a woman who vanished, a motel ledger tracking people like cargo, burned schools, sealed courtrooms, dumping grounds with children's bones. This isn't fiction. This isn't urban legend. These are shadows of justice, real crimes buried beneath red tape and scorched earth. My name is Marcus Ellery, and if you're hearing this, I might already be gone. But the truth is still out there, and it lives in the places we were told to forget. Oh, by the way, if you haven't already, we invite you to follow us on your favorite platform so you never miss a story. The Whispering Walls. You can always tell when a place doesn't want to be found. It hums differently, like the silence has weight. The old Kingsbrook Asylum sat 3 miles off a forgotten service road in upstate New York, choked by overgrowth and encased in rot. Officially condemned in 1992, unofficially, it had been absorbing secrets for decades. The front gates were rusted open. No trespassing signs dangled like broken promises. I ducked beneath a fallen archway, flashlight in hand, camera strapped to my chest. I made my way into the belly of the building. Dust clung to the air like ash. "The walls," they whispered. "Not literally. Of course, I'm not some haunted YouTuber chasing clicks. But there's something about hospitals, especially ones with padded rooms and locked drawers, that makes you feel like you've just interrupted someone mid-scream." I wasn't there for ghosts. I was there for evidence. I'd followed a tip from an anonymous email. Said there was a file hidden in Ward C, one the state never recovered during the shutdown. Something about unacknowledged deaths and misused government funds. A red flag wrapped in red tape sounded like bullshit, but I went anyway. Through the cracked tiles and caved-in ceilings, I reached Ward C. The door was surprisingly intact. Someone had spray-painted Shadows of Justice across it in blood-red ink. Not graffiti. A warning. Inside, the stench hit first. Mold, rust, and something else. Something acrid and unnatural. I panned my light over the nurse's station. Cabinets pried open. Floor littered with rotting paper. Then I saw it, a manila envelope. Water-stained but still sealed. Shoved behind a broken drawer. It was labeled Unveiled Internal Audit 2001. I opened it right there on the floor. Too hungry to wait. The first page was a patient intake form, one that didn't match the hospital's official records. I compared it to a public access log I'd downloaded the night before. The name, Talia Monroe, wasn't on it. Neither were 6 others listed in that envelope. No police reports, no missing persons files, just ghosts trapped in bureaucracy. Each file ended the same way. Patient transferred. No further documentation. Transferred where? Why weren't they listed in the state database? And why the hell was there a receipt showing wire transfers from an offshore account in the Cayman Islands to a hospital foundation that no longer existed? That's when I knew this wasn't just about a forgotten hospital. It was about money, power, cover-ups. I should have stopped there, but I'm not built like that. Curiosity is a disease I caught young. I took the files, wrapped them in plastic, and snapped a few shots of the room. But something shifted then. I heard it. A footstep. Deliberate. Heavy. Not mine. I turned. Light slicing through the hallway behind me. Nothing. Another step. Closer. Then silence. I backed out of the room. Camera still rolling. My hands were shaking. I'm not ashamed to admit that. Anyone who tells you fear feels cinematic is lying. It's not bold. It's not brave. It's piss-in-your-throat terror. I moved fast through the corridor, past graffiti that hadn't been there when I arrived. New ink, still dripping. You were never alone. I made it to the main entrance and pushed through the rusted doors, like the building was swallowing behind me. Once I reached my car, I sat there, breathing hard. The envelope still clutched in my lap. The story should have ended there. It didn't. That night, someone uploaded one of my photos to a private Bookstagram group I'd never heard of. Captioned, "Another one digging too deep." My account had never posted that image. Someone was watching me, and they had access to my files. That's when I realized this isn't about exploring decay. It's about exposing financial crimes, unreported deaths, and a justice system that left bodies behind in places no one dares to remember. Places like Kingsbrook, places that whisper, the Motel Ledger. They say the desert preserves everything. I didn't really believe that until I found a human tooth in the drain of room 6. The Sandcrest Motel had no business still standing. Half the roof was gone. Sand had poured into the lobby like time's slow revenge. A rusted sign creaked above the broken neon letters. Stay a while. A sick joke, considering what I found. I was in Arizona, following the paper trail from Kingsbrook. That envelope, the one labeled unveiled, had a slip of torn paper tucked deep inside. It was barely legible, but I caught the name, Sandcrest Foundation. Not the motel, the same name listed in those Cayman Island wire transfers. So I drove 8 hours through blistering heat and bad coffee to see if there was more behind that name than coincidence. There was. Room 6 looked like every other rotting room at first. Sun bleached, ransacked, but something about it didn't feel abandoned. The sheets were old, but they weren't covered in dust. The closet door was cracked slightly open, and the lock on the inside had been manually removed. I flicked on my flashlight and crouched. That's when I saw the ledger. It was shoved between the closet's wall slats, wrapped in a plastic grocery bag. Water damaged, but still readable. Dozens of names, dates, times, each one next to a set of initials and something else. SF, CN, TR, codes. I didn't understand them yet. But the last few entries had notes scribbled in the margins. Quiet. Pretty. Kept her mouth shut. Not the first. No paper trail. That's when I found the tooth in the sink. It wasn't an accident. I took pictures of the ledger, every page. My hands were shaking again. I don't know if it was the heat or the feeling that I'd stepped into someone's unmarked grave. The whole place was wrong. I mean, it looked like a dying motel off I-19. But it felt like a holding cell. A place where people were dropped off and forgotten. I opened the mini-fridge on instinct. Inside was a strip of old duct tape, with a single name written in faded ink. Lily Marston. I hadn't heard that name in years. We went to the same journalism seminar back in college. She was brilliant. Quiet. Obsessed with whistleblowers and financial corruption. We weren't close. But I remember her talking about working on a Justice Tales expose. Something about the overlap between mental institutions, private funding, and offshore accounts. She vanished 3 years ago. Everyone assumed she left the country. Some said suicide. Some said she just cracked under pressure. Now I knew the truth. She had been here. I left that room with my throat dry and my mind spinning. Back at the car, I flipped through the ledger again. The initials, the codes, the dates. Then it hit me. The ledger didn't track stays, it tracked deliveries. Each entry wasn't a guest, it was a victim. Bureaucratic human trafficking, covered with just enough red tape to make it all disappear. All funded under shell organizations, hidden under innocuous foundation names, filtered through financial scams that led right back to the same damn Cayman account. This wasn't a motel, it was a middle point. A place where shadows of justice operated in silence. I reported it. Of course I did. Sent the entire file to a trusted contact in the press. No names. No traces. Just coordinates. Photos. And a burner number. No response. 3 days later, my email was wiped. So was the burner phone. I tried calling my contact. Number disconnected. That was the day I realized. I'm not documenting true crime stories anymore. I'm living one. The school beneath the stains. I never expected to find blood beneath a basketball court, but there it was, dark, dried, unspread in deliberate patterns, under the floorboards of an abandoned elementary school in St. Francisville, Louisiana. A school long closed, its brick walls sunken and split, sagging under decades of secrets. St. Mary's Elementary was supposed to have closed due to budget cuts, but locals told a different story. One janitor said the gym was sealed for good reason. Another swore the place was cursed. Whispers of screams, of buses arriving at night and leaving empty. No one talked loud. No one made eye contact when I brought it up. That's always a sign something's real. So I went in. The front entrance was barricaded, so I entered through a broken basement window, cut my arm on the frame, left a smear of myself on the concrete going in. Fitting. Inside, it smelled like wet wood and mildew. Classroom desks were scattered like a storm had passed through. Mold bloomed in patterns on the walls. I took slow steps, flashlight scanning over cracked murals and torn bulletin boards. It didn't feel like a school anymore. It felt like a cover-up. The gym was padlocked, but the door was soft with rot. One kick, and it gave in. The second I stepped inside, the air changed, not just in temperature, but in weight. I felt that before, in Kingsbrook, in Sandcrest. That silence that tastes like death. My boots echoed against the warped gym floor as I walked towards center court. That's where I saw the discoloration, smeared across the polished planks like a forgotten painting. Someone had tried to sand it out. Tried and failed. I crouched and chipped at the wood with a multi-tool. The stain bled deeper than the surface. That's when I decided to pull the boards up. And beneath them, wrapped in plastic, sealed tight, was a body. I didn't scream. Not because I wasn't afraid, but because I was already numb. Rigor mortis had long faded. And the face was gone. Just bone and rot. Taped to the ribs was a single page from a grant application. St. Mary's receives emergency mental health funding. Expedited by Education Bureaucracy Order 120897. There it was again. The same bureaucracy. The same shell organizations. The same financial corruption hiding under community outreach. I took photos. Every inch. I knew not to touch the remains. I checked for more documents. Found a folder tucked inside a maintenance closet. Slips of paper. Shredded invoices. And a typed letter with the header. Re Sandcrest Foundation. Student transfer protocols. Protocols? Students? Transfers? This wasn't just one school. This was a system. I uploaded the photos to a hidden server and left the scene. I called the local police from a payphone, used an old pseudonym, told them about the body. I knew what would happen, an investigation, followed by a closed-door decision, and then nothing. Just another true story swallowed by red tape. But this time, someone called me back. Not the cops, a voice, modulated, digitized. They knew my name. They knew Kingsbrook. They mentioned the offshore accounts. They said, "You're connecting too many dots. Stop digging, Marcus." Then they hung up. I couldn't sleep that night. Every creak of the house felt like footsteps. I started keeping the lights on. I rigged a camera above my door, because now I knew they weren't just watching me. They were warning me. I flew to Denver the next morning. Lily Marston's last known residence. I needed to know how deep she'd gotten before she vanished. Because I was already starting to see the shape of something massive. A web of financial crimes, child disappearances, and buried documents stretching across state lines and decades. And I was standing right in the middle of it. The archivist's apartment, Denver, was cold in a way that got inside your bones. Not the kind of cold you escape with a jacket, but the kind that clings to your ribs and whispers. "You shouldn't be here." Lily Marston lived in Unit 4B of a sun-bleached apartment complex just outside the university district. She'd been gone for over 3 years. No official forwarding address. No lease termination. Nothing. Just gone. But the landlord never cleaned the place out. Said it gave him the creeps. That's how I got in. The apartment was a time capsule. Mugs still on the counter. Papers scattered like she left in the middle of a thought. A corkboard above her desk, pinned with strings, maps, photos, and names. My name was one of them. Next to it, Kingsbrook. Below that, red tape, dumb pattern. And across the top, bold black ink. "Shadows of justice, do not trust them." Lily had been deeper than I ever imagined. Boxes filled with manila folders, each labeled by state. Inside were public school grants, hospital closures, court transcript, and cross-reference financial reports, each marked with a color-coded sticker system. Blue for unexplained funds, red for missing persons, green for offshore transfers. It wasn't paranoia. It was journalism weaponized. Then I found the drive. a simple 16GB USB tucked behind a false panel in her bookshelf. I didn't plug it in, not yet. I'd learned by now that whatever Lily had found, it was dangerous enough to get her killed. I copied its contents to 3 encrypted backups and burned it onto a disk. Only then did I open the files. They weren't just documents. They were audio recordings. One stood out, Lily's voice, shaky, late at night. She sounded exhausted, but determined. I found the missing transfer protocols, Sandcrest, St. Mary's, and a third site in Illinois, connected through shell accounts. This isn't random, it's systemic. Children are being funneled through treatment facilities, funded by dummy non-profits. The money disappears. So do the people. There are layers, banks, false charities, trust funds tied to financial corruption on a national scale. If something happens to me, follow the trail. Follow the abandoned. Then a pause. And something I'll never forget. Marcus, if you're hearing this, they're already watching you. But that's when the lights in the apartment cut out. Dead silence. No hum of the fridge. No street noise. Just my own heartbeat. Punching the inside of my chest. I grabbed my phone. Dead. No signal. I crept to the front door. Pulled it open slowly. A black SUV idled at the curb. Not moving. Not leaving. Just waiting. I closed the door quietly, pulled the curtains shut, and dropped to the floor. I stayed like that for what felt like hours. The SUV was gone when I finally looked again, but they wanted me to know they'd been there. I left Denver that night with Lily's drive duct-taped inside the lining of my jacket, and I made a promise I would finish what she started, no matter where it led, no matter who it exposed. This wasn't about haunted places anymore. This was about a coordinated operation of financial scams disguised as charity, a world of bureaucracy designed to hide human suffering behind tax breaks and grant applications. Justice tales no one ever dared to tell out loud, until now. The fire at Birchwood Estate. They said it was an accident. A space heater left too close to a curtain. Faulty wiring. No foul play. But Birchwood Estate didn't burn itself to the ground. I drove upstate under the cover of fog. The road winding like a nervous thought. Birchwood sat on 16 acres of private land, walled off by trees that had grown wild since the blaze 2 years ago. The official report said the fire was swift and total. What remained was a skeleton, charred brick columns, warped metal railings, and a basement that smelled like scorched secrets. But the truth always leaves something behind. The estate had once belonged to a non-profit youth rehabilitation center. You wouldn't find it on Google Maps anymore. The charity that owned it, New Beginnings Forward Foundation, had dissolved just weeks after the fire. No criminal charges, no survivors, no explanation. But Lily's files told a different story. She had flagged the foundation's 501c3 tax returns with red stickers. Showed over $4.6 million routed through 6 different offshore accounts. She'd even traced some of it back to the Sandcrest Foundation. Everything circled back. Kingsbrook, St. Mary's, Sandcrest, Birchwood. This wasn't a coincidence. It was a circuit. I parked half a mile out and walked the rest. The wind howled through the ruins like it had a voice of its own. I descended into the remains of the basement, careful not to shift the unstable concrete too much. That's when I saw it. A metal filing cabinet. Burned but still intact. Sealed shut with rust and something else, something melted. It took me half an hour and a pry bar to get it open. Inside were singed pages, memos, invoices, program outlines. The title at the top of the first page made my stomach lurch. Birchwood Behavioral Transfer Program, Final Phase. Below it, a list of names. Most were children. But then I saw hers, Lily Marston. Not as a staff member. As a subject, her name was penciled in, not typed, red ink. Next to it, the initials TR, same as I'd seen in the Sandcrest Motel ledger. I stood in the dark and tried to breathe. That meant she'd been taken here. Maybe she'd escaped. Maybe she'd never left. And maybe, just maybe, they'd killed her for knowing too much. I scanned every page, took photos, every word, every corner, every half-burned letter. I needed it all. I needed proof. But then I noticed something worse. One of the pages had a hand-drawn map. It outlined every site I'd visited so far: Kingsbrook, Sandcrest, St. Mary's, and now Birchwood. But there was a fifth site, unmarked, no name, just a red X, in West Virginia. That was the next stop. But before I left, I walked the perimeter of the house again. That's when I found the scorch mark on the trees. Too focused, too perfect, like an incendiary device had been placed there. An arsonist's footprint. I crouched, ran my fingers through the ash, and found what I already feared. A metal pin, charred black. The symbol faint but visible. Three interlocking circles. The same symbol I'd seen stamped into the foundation grant papers. I looked up and saw something move in the distance. A figure, still, watching, then gone. I didn't sleep that night. I drove straight through the state line with the GPS off and my phone in a Faraday pouch. I was starting to feel less like a journalist and more like a fugitive from someone else's crime, someone powerful. Because when I started digging into financial crimes, I expected shell companies and bureaucracy, not unmarked graves, not burned children, not Lily. If Birchwood was the final phase, what the hell was that red X? And what did they do to the ones who got too close?